I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, our Thursday look at all things election-related. We're going to take a break from covering local races and issues today and check in with three states, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Georgia. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker survived a recall vote and now faces Democrat Mary Burke. And according to the latest polls, the race is pretty much a dead heat. Joining us is Mary Spicuzza, and she's state government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. And Mary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So how close is the race today?
Extremely close. The latest Marquette Law School poll showed them tied with likely voters, the voters who say they're committed to going to the polls on Election Day. So they are really neck and neck down to the wire.
Is this a change, the fact that the race is so close today?
Yes. You know, I've been covering Governor Walker since he won, I guess since 2009, and I don't remember polls being this close for him ever. Typically, he was up, 5 points, 6 points, up to 8 points, and he won the recall by a larger margin than a lot of people expected. And so I think some people originally thought that this would be not this tough of a race for him, but it has proved to be just extremely tight.
Why do you think that is, Mary?
I think there are a few different reasons. I think Mary Burke, even though she's never run for statewide office before, I think she has really exceeded a lot of people's expectations as a candidate. She's had some stumbling blocks. There was some copying in her jobs plan that she attributed to a consultant and cut ties with him. But, and she has had some stumbling blocks, but overall, I think she has done far better than a lot of people expected. Also, a lot of people say this is about Governor Walker, and he obviously made some enemies during his first term. There were the 2011 protests that brought tens of thousands of protesters to the Capitol for, week after week on his proposal to all but end collective bargaining for public workers. Then he did survive the recall, but since then, there have been a lot of bills that have been controversial, and I think a lot of he's definitely made some enemies during his time in office.
Would it be fair to say his critics are energized and are perhaps likely to go to the polls?
I think that they are, yeah. Even though it's not a presidential year, obviously if it was a presidential year, that would be a big boost to Democrats here since Barack Obama won Wisconsin both years, and typically the state does go for Democrats in presidential races. So that is a bit of an obstacle. But I do think that a lot of Democrats are energized, and they're doing a lot of get-out-the-vote efforts. We've had First Lady Michelle Obama make two trips, one to Madison, one to Milwaukee. The president is expected to come on Tuesday. Bill Clinton is going to be here on Friday. So there's certainly a lot of national attention going to this race, and they do, I think they really feel like this is going to come down to turnout, and if they can energize the base, that side's going to win.
I read a quote from Sharon Day. She's a co-chair of the Republican National Committee and was in Wisconsin and said, and this is a quote here, "I don't want to say anything about your Wisconsin voters, but some of them may not be as sharp as a knife." That has got to hurt Governor Walker.
That was probably not the wording that you would want to use. I think among his, I don't think it would necessarily hurt him among his base. And I think one of the things that we're seeing here is there are so many voters who are decided. It almost seems like finding undecided voters is like finding a needle in a haystack. So I don't know that it'll hurt him much among his base. But those few undecided voters who are still out there probably wouldn't necessarily appreciate hearing that.
How many debates have there been between these two candidates, Governor Walker and Mary Burke?
There have just been two.
And what have they been like? Any reveal from those debates?
They both, I don't think, it's one of those where both sides said the kind of declared victory afterwards, which we see all the time in these debates. I think that, again, Mary Burke did a lot better than people many people expected, and maybe that was, I don't know if that was that a lot of people had low expectations because she's a first-time statewide candidate. She did stumble in the first debate on kind of a question that was almost seemed like a, give me question, where it was just to say something nice about your opponent. And she stumbled with that one. But again, I don't think that her supporters obviously are not huge fans of Governor Walker, and I don't know that that really cost her too much among her supporters that she struggled to say something nice about the governor.
I'm curious, Mary, what did she end up saying, or perhaps what did her stumble sound like?
It was kind of just like a pause, and maybe they didn't practice that question in debate in her debate prep. She ended up saying that it was quite a pause. He went first and said that she'd done a lot of work with Boys and Girls Club and he admired her philanthropy. She said that ended up saying his work with survivors of domestic violence, and then kind of said, and him and his wife's philanthropy too. She was asked about it again in an edit board with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and asked to say, I think, 5 nice things about her opponent. And she kind of, she said that she thought, I think she said that he was a family man, and first she said he's a good politician, which was maybe not like the most gushing praise that you could give somebody. And then she said, mentioned him being devoted to his family or being a good family man. But then she kind of said, I'm a very real person, and I don't. This has been a pretty nasty race, and I basically just saying that she's not a career politician and isn't good at kind of saying the politically correct thing, and it's just very straightforward. So, overall, I don't think that that's really going to cost her too much support among her supporters. And I think both debates, I can't really say that one person flopped and one person clearly won. I'm sure their supporters feel differently.
I'm sure they do. We're calling you from Pennsylvania, where there's a governor's race as well. And really the top issue in this state has to do with education and education funding. And I'm curious about in Wisconsin, what seem to be the driving issues for that state?
There's been a lot of talk over Governor Walker in his first run. Well, his successful run in 2010 when he won, he made a pledge that 250,000 jobs would be created in his first term. That has not happened. I think more than 100,000, but not tons more than 100,000. So that has been a big point of discussion. Mary Burke worked for Trek Bicycle, which was founded by her father and has had a business experience. She was Commerce Secretary. So she's really been hammering the governor on job creation and saying that, he has failed at his promise and should not win a second term. He says, I aimed high. That was a goal. And, nobody should punish me for having high goals. So job creation has been one that they have talked about quite a bit. They do differ dramatically on pretty much any issue you can think of. So you mentioned education. Governor Walker has pushed for school choice and vouchers. He's talked about expanding that if he wins re-election. Mary Burke is a Madison school board member. She opposes voucher expansion. On abortion, Governor Walker has been endorsed by 100% pro-life groups. He opposes abortion even in cases of rape and incest. Mary Burke is pro-abortion rights on gay marriage. She supports it. He supported the ban on gay marriage here, which was not upheld in the courts. So pretty much on any issue, I think they've both tried to focus on economics. And Governor Walker certainly is not one that is very eager to talk about social issues and often says this isn't what voters care about. Voters want to hear about the economy and jobs, and they don't, these are kind of side issues. But certainly there are some voters who do want to, hear sure. about candidate stances sure. on abortion or gay marriage.
I'm looking at a headline actually from, looks like this week, where the state attorney general in Wisconsin is basically giving up on reinstating the voter ID law. Can you expand on that, Mary?
Sure. So that was something that was passed by the Republican legislature. They had been pushing for that for a while. Then when Governor Walker first won and took office in 2011, the Republicans gained control of the Senate and Assembly here. So really, his agenda has largely passed. That was something that he and the legislature both supported, signed into law, but then very quickly it was in place for a very minor spring election before being blocked by the courts as unconstitutional. It has, you know, it's been kind of, there have been multiple lawsuits, fights on multiple fronts. The state Supreme Court took it up and basically kind of offered a fix for it. They kind of tweaked the law, which seemed unusual to me, but that basically making it free to get IDs. So they then appealed and tried to say, okay, look, it's constitutional now. And it went all the way, you know, it hasn't been taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court on its merits yet, but it was blocked. And the court said, you cannot implement this in time, you know, for this November election. And there were a lot of, there were absentee ballots that had already gone out. And so it was looking like it was going to be just pretty chaotic and confusing trying to implement that with just weeks left before the election.
How much money has been spent, do you know, so far on this particular race in Wisconsin? And are TVs just, you know, one blitz of ad after another for the candidates?
They are. It's funny because during the recall, there's kind of a glitch in state law here that says a candidate facing recall can raise unlimited amounts of money at points in their recall. So Governor Walker was getting just enormous amounts of money. Bob Perry from Texas sent, gosh, I want to say $250,000. So there was just enormous amounts of money flowing during the recall, and labor unions and everybody else on both sides were just dumping just money that we had never seen before into that race. So it's kind of funny. By comparison, this seems to be a little bit more modest spending. I mean, it's still, you know, millions of dollars, and there are still, it seems like there are new ads on every day, either TV or radio. I have not been able to turn on my TV and not see an ad, including, you know, at the gym I see them when I'm trying to forget about the race. But yeah, they are pretty much, they're everywhere.
Well, on that note, Mary, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times and giving us an update on the governor's race in Wisconsin.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And again, that's Mary Spicuzza, state government reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, the first of three guests in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Again, taking a break from some of the local issues that we have been covering and some of the local races that we've been covering, and checking in with three states that we think have some pretty interesting things going on. And up next, we'll be talking about Kansas. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Build-A-Bridge International supports WHYY and will host their Hopeful City Gala at WHYY on November 8th, highlighting the important role of art and creativity in bringing healing to children experiencing trauma and homelessness. On hand will be Councilman David O., Chief Cultural Officer Helen Haynes, and Project Runway winner Dom Streeter for this evening of interactive art making and auctioning of artwork, presenting a collective vision for a more hopeful city where children can grow and develop. More at hopefulcity.org.
Philadelphia Theater Company, now in its 40th anniversary season, supports WHYY and presents Pulitzer Prize finalist Detroit, a startling new American play. This dark comedy follows Ben and Mary and the unusual couple who've moved into the deserted house next door. As they bond over backyard barbecues and booze, what starts as a neighborly friendship builds to shocking revelations and consequences. Detroit features an all-Philadelphia cast and runs October 10th through November 9th at the Suzanne Roberts Theater. Tickets at philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent school for pre-K through grade 8. Montgomery School believes when children find joy in learning, they are inspired to explore their world and succeed in their educational pursuits. Montgomery's teachers help bring out the best in each student. The school will host an open house on October 26th at 1 p.m. on their campus in Chester Springs. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed.
I'm Marty Moscowen. It's Ballot Talks Thursday on Radio Times when we discuss election-related issues. We were curious about what's been happening in Kansas, normally a reliable moderate Republican state, but not this year when you look at the races for governor, for U.S. Senator, and for Secretary of State. Dave Helling is a reporter and columnist for the Kansas City Star and joins us on Radio Times to tell us what's been going on in Kansas. And Dave, nice to have you with us on the show.
Great to be with you, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. Is it unusual to put Kansas in the spotlight in an off-year election?
Well, it's unusual to have competitive races, that's for sure. In fact, a year ago when we were talking about what might happen in Kansas this year, I think the assumption everyone had is that the Republicans might have primary contests in August that were a little messy, but after that was over, it would be a victory lap for Sam Brownback, the incumbent governor, and Pat Roberts, the incumbent senator. And that, of course, has not even remotely been the case. They're in the fights of their lives, and with less than 2 weeks to go, both races still far too close to call.
Well, let me ask you about Brownback, who basically said when he was elected that he wanted to make the state a real-life experiment of conservative ideas. What were those conservative ideas, and how did they get instituted in your state?
Well, yeah, he regrets using the word experiment now because it's being thrown back in his face. But in essence, when he took office a little less than 4 years ago, Sam Brownback said that he needed or thought he needed to do something in Kansas to convince people to move back to the state and to begin to build jobs and rebuild the economy. And his answer was a dramatic reduction in the state's tax structure and particularly its income taxes. He lowered income taxes for almost all taxpayers, and eliminated taxes on small business income, LLCs, that type of thing. And so, in essence, the idea was to give massive income tax incentives for people to move back into the state and to create jobs. So far, the verdict on that gambit is out. It doesn't appear as if it has provided what Brownback called a shot of adrenaline to the economy. But the bigger problem is that the tax cuts have blown a huge hole in the budget in the state. And, that has led to at least some suggested cuts in spending for education, which is always a problem in Kansas. Credit rating agencies have downgraded the state's debt, which is in Kansas particularly damaging politically. People are, acquainted with debt in this state, and they know how quickly that can get out of hand. So I think the judgment on whether or not his experiment will work may be a couple of years away, but the immediate verdict by voters seems to be that what has happened is not a good thing for the state of Kansas.
So what does Brownback say in defense of what he did?
Well, he has not backed away. To his credit, he has said, look, we had to do something. We were losing populations to other states. We had to take some aggressive steps to reorient the state. He said repeatedly, we're going after Texas, which has no income tax, and his goal is to get to a zero income tax in the state of Kansas. But what he has said in the last 6 months is something he did not say 3 years ago, and that is it's going to take some time. You need to be patient. We're now poised to grow, he'll say. And it's just a question as to whether Kansans are willing to give him another 4 years to wait and see if this economic miracle that he promised will come to the state. In the meantime, credit downgrades, cuts to education, lack of jobs, all of that are causing major political problems for him.
Now, his challenger is House Minority Leader Paul Davis. What does he bring to the conversation? What is his pitch to the people in Kansas?
Well, Paul Davis is a member of the state legislature in the House. He's been there for 12 years, relatively well-known, a leader in the Democratic Party in Kansas for many years, which, by the way, isn't saying much because the Democrats are just not really much of a player in a normal cycle in the state. But, he's very competent, I don't want to say soft-spoken, but, quiet, not certainly flamboyant or verbose in any way. But his argument, Marty, is simply, I'm not Brownback. That whatever Sam Brownback has done, I will at least stall or try to undo. It's really, as it usually is in these cases, as you know, a referendum on the incumbent. It's really, do you like Sam Brownback, And if not, is Paul Davis an acceptable alternative? I think most Kansas voters would say yes, that we'll at least consider the Democrat, but it really is a referendum on Sam Brownback.
Dave, let me ask you something I was reading, and this goes back to 2012, that Brownback supported a number of very conservative challengers against moderate Republicans.
Yes.
How much has that, I guess, hurt him within even his own party?
Well, a lot. And there, you may have read this as well. There was about 3 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, my timing may be off a little bit, but a group of prominent former Republican office holders very publicly endorsed Paul Davis, the Democrat. They said that they thought Sam Brownback's experiment had not worked, had not done what he had promised to do. And so you do have moderate Republicans who remain furious about that 2012 election, in essence doing what they can to encourage the Davis candidacy. And really, that's how this election in Kansas for governor will be decided. Where do the moderates go? Do they go home to the Republican Party that they've known for decades, or do they say, in essence, we'd prefer to give the Democrat a chance? Kansas is a very Republican state. It hasn't elected a Democratic senator since the Great Depression. But on occasion, they will support Democrats for governor. Kathleen Sebelius, a name your listeners might recognize,
absolutely,
was governor in Kansas, elected twice, and then she quit to go to Washington to run the Health and Human Services Department. So she was elected governor. John Carlin, Joan Finney, there is a history of Kansans giving Democrats a chance at the state's top job. And we may be seeing that play out again this year.
As we know, or as we should know, Kansas, the home to Koch Industries. Are the Koch brothers playing a role in election politics in your state?
Yeah, they are playing a bit of a role in the governor's race. You know, one of the things your listeners, Marty, will know quite well is that a lot of this money in politics today is secret money. And tracing it is very difficult. But we do get a sense that the Kochs have some involvement in the governor's race. They are much more heavily involved in the Senate race to try and protect Pat Roberts, who is also in trouble. There's a group called Freedom Partners that has spent a couple of $1 million out here, which in the context of, you know, Kentucky or North Carolina doesn't sound like a lot, but in Kansas, a couple of $1 million can go pretty far. So the Kochs seem much more interested in the Senate race maybe than the governor's race here.
And I do want to talk about the Senate race. Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Dave Helling. He's a reporter and columnist for the Kansas City Star. And in this Ballot Talks edition of Radio Time, something we do every Thursday at this time, we're checking in on a couple of different states besides the ones here in the Delaware Valley, and he's telling us about some of the races in Kansas. If you want to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Dave, you mentioned the Senate race, and this is Pat Roberts running for re-election, being challenged in this race by an independent, a guy named Greg Orman. What's happening here?
Well, it's the most interesting, most unique Senate race in the country, I think, this year. Pat Roberts is a 40-year veteran of Kansas politics, first elected to the U.S. House in 1981, running for his fourth term as a senator from the state of Kansas, a Republican, of course, in a very Republican state. And he, too, almost certainly anticipated a race this year that would be, in essence, a victory lap. He's never had a serious challenge in his entire career. And then he got a pretty aggressive primary opponent, a Tea Party opponent, a guy named Milton Wolf, who ran, you know, fairly aggressively at Roberts, particularly because Pat has a bit of a problem in the state with some perception that he doesn't really live here, that he lives in Virginia, just comes back to visit occasionally. As you know, that can be a problem for long-term incumbents, that they, in essence, have gone native, at least in the eyes of some voters. And Milton Wolf made much of that in his campaign and surprisingly did very well in the primary, held Pat Roberts to under 50% of the vote in the Republican Party.
Wow.
So that was the first, you know, hint that Pat was in trouble. And then Greg Orman, a relatively, I don't want to say well-known, but certainly someone who has looked at these races before, a businessman from the eastern part of Kansas, decided to get in and was able to raise some money and run as an independent, not as a Democrat or a Republican. And in fact, as your listeners may know, there was a Democrat nominated for the Senate race in Kansas, but he left the race. He literally quit the ballot. There were some court pushing and shoving. But there is no Democrat on the ballot in Kansas for the Senate this year. So all of that is focused on Greg Orman. And again, that race far too close to call. The fact that he's an independent does have some resonance in Kansas, because like a lot of other voters in a lot of other states, people out here are disgusted with their federal government, and they may be taking it out on Pat Roberts.
Is Greg Orman a Bernie Sanders-type independent or more conservative independent?
Say, you know, one of the problems one of the issues reporters face out in Kansas is trying to get a good bead on Greg Orman. He has no voting record, never held public office, so it's a little difficult. He holds basically left-of-center views, certainly not in Bernie Sanders territory by any means. But you know, he's, for example, he supports same-sex marriage. He's pro-choice on abortion. He wants to close the gun show loophole. So he's given to Democrats before, and in 2008 ran briefly as a Democrat. So you get the sense that he's left-of-center, certainly left of Pat Roberts, who went far right because of the Tea Party challenge. Having said that there are some interesting notes of sort of a libertarian conservative approach from Greg Orman, and he has not said yet, despite our best efforts to get him to say one way or another, he has not told the voters whether he'll join the Democrats or Republicans if he's elected to the Senate. That remains an open question with a week to go. Roberts has made much of that, you know, you can't pin Greg Orman down, but again, the independence of this candidacy does have some resonance in a state where everyone is just as upset with Congress as the rest of the country.
Dave, one of the things that you have written is that both these candidates, Davis and Orman, who have thin resumes, that could be an advantage for them, perhaps because it's an off-year election and also because so many people are so frustrated with a status quo when it comes to politics.
Right, Marty, just as in the governor's race, the Senate race is another referendum on the incumbent. I wrote a couple of weeks ago that if this race is anybody but Pat Roberts, Greg Orman is happy to be anybody. And I think that's the dynamic in both races, that the Democrat and the independent are saying, look, judge Pat Roberts, judge Sam Brownback. And if you think they have not done the job you think they should do, then I'm an acceptable alternative. And so that's some frustration for the Republicans. That certainly can frustrate reporters who would like a little more specificity from both candidates. But I think their strategy is basically, you know, been let's judge these two long-term incumbents who've been in office for more than a quarter century. Everyone in Kansas knows Sam Brownback. Everyone knows Pat Roberts. And so really in a week, the voters will render their verdict and we'll see what they decide.
We're also interested in the Secretary of State race. Chris, is it Kobach or Kobach?
Kobach, Chris Kobach.
Kobach is a, shall we say, controversial candidate, but well known, yes. not just in Kansas, but in other states as well, because of immigration laws and also because of voting laws as well.
Right. He's a national figure. He's been involved in Arizona and in other states. Drafting legislation that some feel is aggressively addresses undocumented workers trying to enter the country. He's a consultant, does it on his own time. He's worked on what some consider to be overly restrictive voter registration laws in the state of Kansas and in other states. He's a well-known national figure in the Republican Party and on the conservative side. He's facing a woman, Jean Schodorf, who was at one time a Republican, now a Democrat, out of Wichita, Kansas. And that race is also close to call. Now, as you might imagine in a state like Kansas, Marty, the dynamics of three competitive Republican races are very complicated. It is hard to imagine that Kansans who have voted Republican all their lives are going to vote against the Republican governor and the Republican senator and the Republican secretary of state. It's just hard to see that happening. And in that sense, Kobach may be getting a bit of a break because, you do sense that the oxygen has been sucked out of his race to be focused on the governor's race and the Senate race, and he may be the beneficiary of that. But he's very complicated. He was heavily involved when the Democrat tried to get off the ballot in the Senate race. Some saw that as overly partisan. So, it would not be surprising if the Democrat wins. it would be a monumental shock if all three Republicans lose in November.
But do you think Kansas is a bit of a test ground for some of these more conservative ideas, and that others in the Republican Party are looking at what might happen come November?
Yes, particularly with Sam Brownback, who has executed the tax-cutting philosophy that goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan in the Republican Party. And as you may know, Brownback has actually run for president and may have some presidential ambitions. I think Republicans, and for that matter, Democrats across the country, are watching the outcome of the Kansas governor's race to determine if the tax-cutting agenda still works in their states, and really for the president in 2016. We'll have to wait and see. Kansans don't like extremism, broadly speaking. They've elected Republicans before, but Bob Dole, Nancy Kassebaum, Bill Graves, the names that some of your listeners may recognize, are generally conceived, if not moderates, at least people who are willing to compromise, willing to try and reach agreement with people across the aisle. Now we have Sam Brownback, who is not interested in compromise at all. We have Pat Roberts, who's not really interested in compromise. And certainly Chris Kobach is not a compromising Republican. So really, we do have you do get the sense there is a bit of a referendum on that approach to government. And if Brownback wins, if Roberts wins, if Kobach wins, then you could see Kansas becoming even more doctrinaire and conservative. But they're in trouble. All three of them are in trouble precisely because lots of people in Kansas, including lots of Republicans, simply don't like that approach.
Sounds like you're going to have a very late night come November. Yes?
We can hardly wait.
I mean, this must be interesting to cover just because things are so fluid and it's not the typical, playbook.
Well, and I'm going to write this column next week, Marty, but it's also Kansas this year shows you how important it is to have two parties in a state. Because typically in Kansas, we don't talk about any of this stuff because the Republican gets 65% of the vote and we all go home. This year, we've had a real, robust, legitimate discussion about important matters of public policy, and that's because all of these races have been competitive, and in states which, like Kansas, are run by one party, this is true of Democrats, too, one-party rule is probably not a good thing for people who live in this country.
Well, we have to say goodbye to you in just a minute, but are there other states that you are watching, or are you so consumed with Kansas politics you don't have time to look up?
Well, we're supposed to watch Missouri, too, but Missouri's kind of boring this year. We don't even have a Senate race. I'm keeping my eye on Iowa, which is just north of us, the Bruce Braley-Joni Ernst race. I think that's fascinating. I wrote a column on the Kentucky race today because I think there's some interesting lessons we can take from that as well. But just to be clear with your audience, all eyes are on the governor's race and the Senate race out here. And again, with a week to go, both of them are well within the margin of error. So voters have some real serious thinking to do in the next week or so.
Well, Dave Helling, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times and telling us about Kansas politics.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. And again, Dave Helling, reporter and columnist for the Kansas City Star, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We began by talking about Wisconsin. We just were talking about Kansas. And coming up next, it's Georgia. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Zollner Art Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY and presents renowned trumpeter, pianist, and composer Arturo Sandoval, Saturday, November 1st. Sandoval is a 10-time Grammy winner and recipient of the 2013 Presidential Medal of Freedom. Tickets at zollnerartcenter.org.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY and is hosting the Cheslin Chase for Open Space on October 25th. This 10K, 5K, and 1.5-mile trail race through the woodlands and meadows of Cheslin Preserve in Unionville, Chester County, will culminate in a post-race party with food and beer from Victory Brewing Company and live music by the Mojo Gypsies. Details at natlands.org/Cheslin Chase. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
Waldron Mercy Academy, a private co-educational Catholic school, supports WHYY, offering child care beginning at 3 months old, traditional pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, kindergarten, Montessori pre-primary, and 1st through 8th grades. Waldron Mercy Academy is located on a 35-acre campus in Marion Station. To learn more, there's an open house on October 26th at noon, 610-664-9847 or waldronmercy.org. Waldron Mercy Academy, celebrating 90 years in mercy.
Supporting WHYY, TIAA CREF Financial Services. More information at TIAA.org. TIAA CREF Individual and Institutional Services, LLC, and Teachers Personal Investors Services, Incorporated.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been checking in on races outside the tri-state area in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. In this final segment, we head down to Georgia to talk about the Senate race between Republican David Perdue and Democrat Michelle Nunn. And joining us is Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And Andra, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So how close is this race between these two candidates?
This race is extremely close. It's been statistically neck and neck since the general election season got underway. Right now, if we look at just the numerical polls, it looks like Michelle Nunn may be up by about 2 percentage points, but the margin of error is plus or minus 4%, so we really can't tell which way it's going.
Now, David Perdue, Michelle Nunn, are these well-known names in Georgia?
Their last names are certainly very well-known names. So these are both novice candidates from famous political families running for an open seat. David Perdue is the cousin of Sonny Perdue, the last governor of the state, and Michelle Nunn is the daughter of Sam Nunn, the former Democratic governor, senator, from Georgia.
And is Perdue the chicken Perdue that we know?
No.
Oh, no. Okay. I wanted to clear that up. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, they came from much more humble beginnings, both Sonny and David Perdue. But David Perdue has distinguished himself as a businessman. So he is kind of a Mitt Romney type of character. So he was CEO of Dollar General, of Reebok, kind of became a turnaround specialist in his field. And so he's garnered a lot of criticism for that because part of his turnaround strategy has involved outsourcing. And while he was CEO of Dollar General, he had to settle a class action lawsuit about wage discrimination. And so Michelle Nunn has used those issues to try to attack David Perdue as perhaps being out of touch with Georgians. And so he's really tried to use this populist message to reach out and try to secure a broad-based coalition.
Does Georgia tend to lean Republican these days?
Yes. So, starting at about 2002 when Sonny Perdue became governor of Georgia, and we started to see in federal elections at the statewide office level sweeps in terms of Senate races, we've expected that Republicans are going to have the advantage. And probably from a numerical standpoint going into this race, Republicans still have that advantage. Democrats have been trying to rebuild. There have been targeted efforts to reach out to minority voters and register them to vote, and that's created its own controversies because there have been allegations of voter registration fraud and allegations of vote tampering and voter suppression going back between the Democrats and Republicans in the state. But what people are preparing for in Georgia, if not in 2014, it would be in a subsequent election cycle, that we would see a large number of African-American, Latino, and progressive white voters that could actually be a very, very formidable force in Democratic politics in the state. And so the Democrats are at least hoping that by 2018, if not shortly thereafter, Georgia would be purple.
Andra, what do voters in Georgia, what do they care about? We're talking about what the candidates have been, how they've been trading, I guess, accusations back and forth. But what do the voters want to hear?
Well, in these races, a lot of things have fallen about economic opportunity, populism, jobs, middle-class values. So Michelle Nunn is trying to tap into those sentiments when she talks about David Perdue as an outsourcing specialist and sort of saying that that doesn't reflect the values of everyday Georgians, nor does that benefit everyday Georgians. David Perdue has tried to present himself as a businessman with know-how who is not corrupted by Washington insiderism, and so therefore he's going to bring a common sense approach to governing. That's part of the reason why he won the primary over three sitting members of Congress and a former Secretary of State. Then in the gubernatorial race, which is also very competitive between Nathan Deal and Jason Carter, the grandson of Jimmy Carter, there's been a lot of talk about education and budgeting, and then also about ethics as well. So all of these issues have certainly been coming to the forefront in various races in the state. There's even a debate about Common Core. When we look at lower down the ticket races, and we're looking at the state's superintendent of education. So, you know, all of these issues have been used in various offices statewide. And so it's just a question of which version of populism a voter is going to respond to.
Some of the Democrats running for national office or running for things like the Senate have distanced themselves from President Obama. What has Michelle Nunn said or not said about the president?
She's done very much the same thing. So she's been coy about whether or not she voted for Barack Obama in 2012. She comes from the nonprofit sector. She was a director at Hands On Atlanta Community Service Organization, and then she became CEO of the Points of Light Foundation, which was founded by President George H.W. Bush. And so she has touted her connections to the Bush family from the outset of her campaign. In fact, for the first few months of her campaign, basically all you heard was, "I'm Michelle Nunn, I used to work for George H.W. Bush." And so she's still touting those, and in fact the Bush family has had to come to her defense when David Perdue suggested that the Points of Light Foundation had made some donations to terrorist organizations. And so she's had to come and defend herself, and Neil Bush has actually come to her rescue. And interestingly, in the state, when we're also talking about Republican-type endorsements, Zell Miller, the former Democratic governor of Georgia, who famously spoke at the 2004 Republican National Convention, has endorsed her for the Senate race, but is endorsing Nathan Deal for the gubernatorial race. So we've certainly seen some very, very interesting bedfellows, and all of that is supposed to be done to present Nunn as a moderate and as a centrist and as somebody who might, in fact, be a little conservative.
And how does President George Herbert Walker Bush feel about being allied with Michelle Nunn?
He's not formally allied with Michelle Nunn. So it was Neil Bush who publicly came out and defended her against the allegations of terrorism in the state. But President Bush has not endorsed Michelle Nunn.
And that was the allegation, that somehow the Points of Light had some association with a terrorist organization?
Yes. So there was earlier this summer, there was a campaign memo that was leaked from the Nunn campaign. So it was a memo that her pollster put together, and they were trying to identify some of Michelle Nunn's weaknesses, as most pollsters will put together for a candidate. And one of the things that was in the memo was that there had been a donation to a Palestinian relief organization, I believe, and that could be perceived or construed as having made a donation to a group that had ties to terrorism.
Well, you are talking about Georgia politics in this portion of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Again, our guest is Andra Gillespie. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And you can join our conversation. Any questions that you might have about Georgia politics, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we normally talk about Delaware Valley politics in this hour of Ballot Talks, and today we decided to check out some of the issues and races in other parts of the country. Andra, let me go back to you, and even going back to this charge or what Perdue said about outsourcing, and it seems like it goes back to a deposition almost a decade ago having to do with the collapse of this company called Pillowtex, and he's quoted as saying, "Yeah, I spent most of my career doing that," meaning doing outsourcing. More recently, he said, "Defend it, I'm proud of it. This is part of American business, part of any business. Outsourcing is the procurement of products and services to help your business run. People do that every day." How much do you think this really is hurting him in Georgia? Because you know, non-business people might not see it that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is an attempt on the part of Democrats to make David Perdue appear to be out of touch. So this would be David Perdue's 47% comment. So it's the type of thing to make him seem out of touch. and also because these jobs are being outsourced overseas and that there are working and lower middle class people who are losing their jobs as a result of some of these business practices, that's the type of thing that suggests that David Perdue would not be the type of senator who would be sensitive to the needs of everyday working Georgians. And one of the things that even Republicans in Georgia have joked about is that, you know, David Perdue has done very well for himself. And so the joke is that he lives on an island in a gated community. So he lives, you know, on an island behind a couple of gates. So it's not just one gated community, but that he has multiple gates. And so if that impression that Perdue is out of touch, lacks empathy with the common person, if that has traction at all, then that could serve to undermine his support at all. You know, also nationally, Democrats have gained a lot of traction talking about equal pay for women. And so the idea that he was involved in a lawsuit and to Mr. Perdue's defense, from what I understand, the lawsuit may have actually started before Perdue was actually CEO of Dollar General. You know, it just sort of undergirds this idea that this is somebody who might help to perpetuate wealth inequalities in the United States, and this is a really sensitive topic. So while on paper our economy is recovering, a lot of people really don't feel that it has. And so Democrats hope to be able to use this portrayal of David Perdue against him to their benefit.
And who has come in from perhaps nationally known figures, or has anyone come in nationally known to campaign or lobby for either of these candidates?
There has definitely been some out of town surrogate campaigning. So let me see. On the Republican side, those have certainly gotten less attention. I think John McCain has been in on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, Michelle Obama and Bill Clinton have been in to campaign for her. So we've certainly seen a lot of that. But I would expect that, you know, there'll be more in the next week. And in particular, one of the interesting wrinkles about Georgia is you have to get 50% of the vote plus one in order to win an election outright. And there is a Libertarian candidate who's polling at about 4% in the polls. And given just how close the margins are between Perdue and none, it's very likely that this is going to run to a runoff. And the gubernatorial race could also run to a runoff for the same reason. Well, this year in Georgia, there are actually going to be two runoffs. They're not going to be on the same day. So the gubernatorial runoff, if it happens, would be in December, and the Senate runoff would be in January. So it would be incredibly difficult to predict who would be advantaged by a runoff in that situation. But what that means is that if the margin in terms of the balance of power in the Senate is razor thin, and if after the Louisiana Senate runoff, which is likely to go to a runoff, it's down to the wire and it's one more seat that determines whether or not the Democrats or the Republicans control the Senate, then I would expect that there would be all hands on deck and that you would see a ton of money, a ton of advertising, but that you would also see any surrogate who could possibly be brought in to bear come to Georgia to try to stump for and fundraise for both candidates.
Hunter, let's get a couple of callers in. Looks like we have Patrick from Winmore joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. With the discussion of outsourcing and you know, business turnaround as an issue in Georgia, I was wondering if the recent spate of corporate inversions where companies are American companies are sort of subsuming themselves into an overseas subsidiary to avoid taxes, if that's seen as an issue or if that's something that is being presented as just another contemporary business practice.
Underkin, can you answer that?
Well, I have not heard of inversion being used against David Perdue, and I also don't have any evidence to suggest that he was involved in any business that may have perhaps taken advantage of inversion rules. So I think it sort of contributes to the larger suspicion of corporate bodies, but I wouldn't say that it necessarily has any impact on sort of how people are perceiving David Perdue.
Patrick, thanks for the call. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm wondering if there's still any political influence with one of the judges you have down there, Leah Sears Collins. And I know she's really come up very quickly over the last 4 or 5 years. And if so, what her impact may be on the election.
Rick, thanks for the call. Andrea, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. She's retired from the bench at this point, and I have not seen her become actively involved in politics. I remembered when Elena Kagan's seat on the Supreme Court first came up, she was definitely mentioned in some media report, so I don't know if perhaps she may be potentially waiting to for another Supreme Court seat if President Obama has the opportunity to name somebody else to the Supreme Court. But I have not seen her be actively involved in politics or endorse candidates in any kind of public way.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Andre, you mentioned Jimmy Carter's grandson running for governor. Is Jimmy Carter considered an influence, a force in Georgia these days?
Absolutely, and especially in Democratic politics. Like, you know, he still remains a very controversial figure, and he's certainly very, very outspoken. But he's the type of person who polarizes people who are probably not inclined to vote for Democratic candidates anyway. So both Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter have been out campaigning for Jason. They've done it on the stump. They, you know, write emails and send out letters on behalf of their grandson. And clearly, Jason Carter, though he is his own political person, he's held a state Senate seat, is certainly benefiting from the family name and the family connection.
And how engaged are voters? That's the sort of riff midterm elections tend to see less engaged people. Are people engaged in Georgia?
Well, I mean, so one would expect that turnout's certainly going to be lower this year than it was 2 years ago, because that's always the case. It's an apples to oranges comparison. But one would expect, given the competitive nature of these races, that turnout's going to be higher relative to, say, 2010 or 2006, just because these are really, really competitive races, and we're not accustomed to having those in Georgia. So I'd expect higher turnout. We're already in early voting in the state, and so far, as of Monday, I think over 200,000 people had cast ballots. It's early. So I would expect that for a midterm election, turnout's going to be pretty robust. But you don't get the same type of electorate in a midterm election that you do in a presidential election. And so that could have an impact on the sort of partisan balance of the vote. And so nationally, Republicans have tended to be the most enthusiastic. And so that would privilege Republicans. And so Democrats have been mindful of this in Georgia. And that was part of the reason for trying to identify as many potential Democratic votes as possible and to try to get them out to the polls. So we'll see whether or not the fruits of their labor actually pan out.
Andre Gillespie, thank you so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University, the third of three guests as we took a little tour around the country to find out what's been happening in other states when it comes to elections. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and tell us if you enjoyed this hour or not. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.